Good afternoon and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 13th, 2000. In the fireside room this afternoon, Margot Gordon will continue her news media and the credibility gap, the promise of civic journalism. Today's session is entitled Civic Journalism, More Than Just Good Journalism. This is session GOM 2000-2. Let's listen in.
I recognize all of you from yesterday, but I'm not quite sure. Am I right? Is there anybody here who wasn't here yesterday? Okay. We spent most of the time yesterday drawing a terrible story, or a depressing story, about where the state of the field of journalism right now. And today I want to try to bring some enlightenment, or some light at the end of the tunnel, as they say, that gives some hope for the situation. And I want to talk about this, something that's relatively new in the field now, variously called civic journalism, public journalism, civic journalism, depending on who you talk to and where the funding came from. It has different names. But in all the instances, it's got a few things in common. And one of the things that cuts across all the definitions of it is that it tries to involve individuals in, engage them in civic processes that are going on. It may also do other things, but that's the main characteristic of it, is trying to get journalists to be more interested in civic life, and in turn, get citizens to be more active and be participants in civic life. It all started with the name public journalism in Miami. One of the head people of the Knight Ridder chain, named Jim Batten, was very concerned about the general decline in newspaper readership all over the country, and also this disconnection between journalists and citizens and their government. And he kind of threw his hands up in the air and said, "What do they want?" Meaning the public. You know, well, what do you want? What do you want? Can any of you say what you'd like to see that you're not getting?
Mm-hmm. Both sides of a story.
Mm-hmm. Both sides of a story, okay. What if there's more than two sides?
Oh, that's the law.
Okay. So, these things don't work very well on this. Maybe we need to run a piece of sandpaper over this glossy thing. Anybody else?
In-depth information.
Superficial article. So you don't have just a one sentence kind of understanding of something.
Pierce the veil of racism.
What?
Pierce the veil of racism. Mm-hmm.
Pierce the veil of racism. And that veil is pretty thick.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of media right now doing everything they can to hire minority journalists. And no matter how hard they try, the percentages stay very low, because partly because they don't offer very high wages. Anything else you'd like to see? I thought you were putting your hand up.
Don't scratch your face at an auction.
Right. Yeah.
Those things that typically aren't considered newsworthy, the good stories, the community.
Good news.
Good news.
Positive,
type.
Right. Not,
okay.
Right. Not negative. Positive.
That old adage, no news is good news.
Right.
Yeah. Good news is no news.
That's right.
Is that the way of putting it? Jody, I bet you get an idea on this one coming from that book you did.
Useful news.
Useful news.
That can move people to act and give them the information they need to act on.
Ah, that moves people. Okay.
But we have a problem, you know, most people don't have the time or the inclination to listen to all sides and in-depth and all this kind of stuff. They just don't want to sit through, don't have time to sit through all that.
Have you ever spent time in England or France? Well, people who had the opportunity to do that often tell me how exciting it is to read the papers over there, because they're so much closer to the story, so much closer to the people involved, and you do get all sides, and it's relatively well known which newspapers are associated with which sides, and so you feel like you have to read more than one in order to get the full story, because you know that you're not going to get the full story if you read just one. And here in this country, we have such a willingness to take a homogenized version of the news that we get from the AP or some other wire service, especially when the news media are being pressured to cut back on the newsroom costs. That makes it very easy for them to depend on wire services instead, but then we get homogenized news.
You said what you want.
You're going to give me trouble, aren't you?
Something that we don't want. We don't want the Monica Lewinsky detail. I don't know how to say that.
We don't want sensational.
We don't want all of that.
You're the only one in the country that didn't want all that.
Lots of people said they didn't want it, and then they tuned in and watched every minute.
Anyway.
Yeah. I'm going to put just M out, so you'll know what I mean by that.
Yeah, it's not just that story, it's a number of them. They're just absolutely getting beat to death. You'd like to never turn your TV news on sometimes, because they keep beating this, like, Elian Gonzalez, went on.
Elian.
Ad infinitum, sick and tired, send the poor kid home.
For our sakes, huh? So, you don't want Monica, well, does that stand for that, to say the same thing? Or were you thinking of sensationalism?
Well, the piece I think, you don't need to know four layers of the personal lives of, you know, I don't know, the news' ability to go too deep in the individual's lives.
Okay, but what you do want is all sides, in-depth, pierce the veil of racism, good news, not all good news, but good news when it's good news, useful news that moves people, and then not so much, not beating a story to death because of the celebrity or, okay.
I would like to hear more international news, I think.
Yes.
And also international perspectives, because I think it's a fresh perspective to have someone from England or France looking at what happening in this country and then offering their perspective.
We live in the capital city of Oregon, and our paper is owned by the Gannett chain, and it's the only paper in town. Oh. And that's about all you get, is what's happening in town.
Well, I think that most journalists are trained to think that what's happening locally is what people are really interested in. But these days, with the whole world getting smaller and smaller, you almost have to have an interest in other things as well.
I read somewhere at the time of the O.J. Simpson story how many hours and thousands, millions, trillions of dollars have been devoted to that. And it happened that was taking place in our lives at the same time as the World Trade Agreement was under discussion. And it seemed to me that if we had used that much time and energy in the media to discuss that agreement and to educate ourselves and learn about different points of view, et cetera, what a difference that would have made.
Yeah.
As it was, I was the only person I knew who didn't listen to one whit of information about O.J. Simpson, which of course excluded me from any conversations.
Well,
but think of all the time I saved.
Yes. You say, now what did you do with that time instead?
Well, I didn't learn about the World Trade Agreement because there wasn't enough information of it.
Yeah. Well, this civic journalism at this point, or public journalism, community journalism, doesn't attack this last question at this point. Although there are people that are beginning to think they should. But meanwhile, I would highly recommend a paper I've just begun reading in the last 3 or 4 months called the Financial Times. It's pink, and it comes, it comes from London, and somehow it arrives in my mailbox the day of publication with that day's date on it. And it's very up-to-date news, and it's, the first section has got lots of interesting international news and the international perspective, but it was a great story on the international perspective on Elion and that whole story. There was also, at the same time, there were lots of stories about Microsoft, which there's a great interest in Seattle. And I was just wondering how many of you are aware that there is a huge, very similar case going on with Visa and MasterCard. The MasterCard Visa case is also a huge antitrust case that affects many more people. And yet you see none of that in our paper. I learned about it in this Financial Times, and they have a story in there usually once or twice a week following up on the latest of what's happened about that. So anyway, that what I'm, the rest of what I'm going to have to say isn't going to have anything to do with international news, I'm afraid to say.
Do you have any idea how many people actually read the newspaper?
How many people read?
What percentage of the American people indulge themselves to actually read the paper?
About 65% say they read a paper yesterday.
Oh.
In a survey. But if you ask the question, do you read every day? The percentage goes down quite a bit to more like 35 or 40%, and it also decreases very drastically by age. Young people do not read newspapers on a regular basis. And 90% of people say that they, 85 to 90%, depending on the part of country you're talking about, say they get their major news from television. But this group, when we asked that yesterday, hardly anybody said that they watch television news on a daily basis. Well, so this is a very unusual group here.
I do, but I also read the newspaper whenever I can, too. So.
Yeah. Now, this public journalism, I made it sound like it's a new thing sweeping the whole field of journalism. And I'd like that to be the case, but that isn't quite true. There are a lot of people who are being persuaded by it, who've tried it and become committed to it. But in the same newsrooms, there will be people who object to it, say that the news staff shouldn't be involved in it, that it's crosses the line, is the word they say. It's too much oriented toward activism, and they think that reporters should just report the facts and not go any further than that. So this question of how widespread it is, first of all, it can't be answered at this point because it's still a relatively new thing that's being tried out, but yet more and more people who try it do seem to be become advocates of it. I'll read you one definition, and then I want to, if the lights stay on, I want to show you a 13-minute film that is that tells about the three winners of one of the awards for this kind of journalism called the Batten Award. And it's after this man, Jim Batten, named after him, who threw up his hands and said, well, what do they want? And then proceeded to tell his reporters and editors that they should go out into the communities, all the night reader newspapers, and find out what people wanted. If they don't want what we're giving them, what do they want? And so they went out and asked. And they got a lot of answers like the ones you gave, and they came back and decided that they were going to try an experiment in the night reader newspaper chain. This was in 1994. And they said, okay, the elections are coming up. One of the things people say is that they're sick and tired of the election coverage. They're sick and tired of the game frame that's used, the winner-loser, horse race, how many points ahead kind of reporting. They want to know more about issues. So that year, they tried, and they encouraged any newspaper in their chain. They said they'd give them extra money to do it, a new way of covering elections. And the Wichita Eagle and the Charlotte Observer took them up on it that first year. And they covered elections in a new way. And they, that by that, they meant that they had, the day, in the week before the election, for example, they had long lists of stands and opinions that the different candidates had on different issues. And they had voters' guides that they handed out to people that wanted them. And they did a number of other things. They focused, they would go out and interview the candidates on the issues that the citizens said were the ones that concerned them in that election. Rather than accepting what it is the candidates said they wanted to talk about, they instead went this other direction. And the citizens really liked it. And the newspaper circulation went up. And more people voted in that election than had in earlier ones. So they began to, it turned them on that those kind of changes were coming about. So after about a year or two of this, the guy who was editor of the Wichita Eagle said, civic journalism is not about agenda setting by the newspaper or the journalists. It's not about me doing forums or causing things to happen. It's an attitude you take into work with you that we have an obligation as journalists to do our journalism in a way that re-engages people. We make spectators out of citizens by saying, look at these fools, or look at this conflict. Isn't it fun to watch? And look at these idiots over there, aren't they silly? Well, that's how you drive people out of public life and make them cynical. And we do that ritualistically. That's how we've been doing our journalism. So now we're trying to do the same stories, but do some of them differently. And in fact, I think you'll see that they don't really do the same stories. Jerry, would you like to come in and turn on the tape? Is that too loud?
Oh, you're fine.
This one is from Maine. It's about alcoholism, the way they took on the story there. A second one is about, it's called About Race, and it's a television production that was done in San Francisco. And the third one is from St. Paul, and is about poverty in that area. I thought I pushed it.
I don't know, but
it's going.
The VCR is the paper for the check.
Oh, okay.
The alcohol.
Did we miss something?
Came out of the water.
Maybe, yeah.
A little
it needs to be a little louder, too, doesn't it?
Yes.
Absolutely. Everything.
Tell me when.
Now.
And then the sound of.
The alcohol, series came out of our managing editor noticing a lot of little briefs and stories in the paper. Everything from traffic accidents to domestic violence. Alcohol seemed to be the common denominator. So he wondered if there was something there. So we put a group of reporters on it, some of our investigative folks, and said, your only charge is to answer this one question. What is the impact of alcohol abuse in Maine? They started to find really amazing data. Maine does not have a lot of statistics on databases, so we had to create databases from paper. And when we started to churn through them, we found some staggering numbers. And as the series went along, we told our reporters and talked to them a lot about writing the piece, putting some compassion and storytelling behind the data. So it was this really wonderful mixture of compelling storytelling and numbers. We ran it in the paper. And every day that the series ran, we got more and more community reaction to it. It was like riding a wave. It was as though people in Maine knew alcohol was a problem, but they did not know the extent of it. And they also didn't really want to talk about it. So when the paper talked about it, it broke this silence. And people, I think, felt comfortable finally addressing it. After the series ran, a group of people from the community came to the newspaper to
to meet with me and the publisher, and they said, you know those things you do called reader roundtables and the study circles? Well, we think you need to do one with this, because everybody in Maine is talking about this. And they all came together, and I think there were 70 to 80 communities that ended up doing something around this topic all over Maine. And some of them started youth centers on their own, and some of them started after-school programs for kids. And it was a whole swath or, you know, spectrum of different solutions that communities came up with, but they did it on their own, and then we wrote about them.
I'll tell you more about that.
What is race? Race isn't science, race isn't biological. Race is something we do to each other.
We were looking for something that we thought would be helped by having a public conversation take place about it. Something that was important, something that was on people's minds, something of particular relevance to the San Francisco Bay Area. And one of the issues that came up was the issue of race relations.
Here's a question for you. How important is race in your daily life?
Every day I wake up and I am very conscious of who I am.
In our newsroom at KRON, we created a task force really to talk about a year-long race relations project and discuss what the components ought to be, how we might approach it, what the format for our stories ought to be, and also what the consequences for our newsroom ought to be.
We begin our story with a pop quiz on genetic science. Here we have a group of four men. If you were able to look just at their genetic code, their DNA, the question is, which of these men have the most genetic differences?
I have no question, given what I know about human genetics, that the tall person and the short person are significantly more different than the two men of a similar height, one black, one white.
The end result was 18 stories that we did over the course of the year. We began with the poll. The kind of showpiece was a five-part series that we ran in our February ratings period. It was unusual in that A, race relations is probably not a typical topic for sweeps. B, the pieces were very long. They ran in our hour-long 6 o'clock news. The first piece was 13 minutes long. The pieces averaged 10 minutes a piece during the course of that week. The ratings were solid. They were comparable to the rest of our rating book. So we came away very pleased with the way the marketplace reacted quantitatively. And qualitatively, we were very, very pleased by the number of emails, letters, calls we got from people who were reacting and wanted to have a continuing conversation about this.
Why do these facts matter? Well, because polls show that whites often underestimate their own numbers and overestimate the numbers of blacks and other minorities, often by double, even triple, the real numbers. And that can affect the way people think, act, and vote on racial issues.
The process isn't over. We have done an audit of our own air, which will be the topic of a series that we're going to do this year, looking at how do we do in our newscasts, how well do we represent the diversity of our area in the topics we cover, the people we interview, what stereotypes are we, inappropriate stereotypes might we be fostering, what contributions are we making?
The previous year or so, one of our best reporters, Linda McDonald, had written a lot of stories about welfare reform and how that was changing our community. And she and her editor, Kate Perry, really, the more they talked about it, the more they kind of came to the conclusion that government was changing the rules, and that meant that the rules for our community were changing. And so the idea was that we could write about the issue of poverty in ways that would let our readers see things that they personally could do to make things better. I think we began by just pulling a bunch of people in the room and brainstorming ideas, and they hit upon the idea of one Sunday a month, or I think it was 7 months, and Glenda Holstey from the editorial page began working with book clubs, and which was a new idea for us this year, and we didn't know whether people would respond to it or not, and of course people went nuts with it. We took a different subject every month
that tied in with the issue of poverty, and wrote about the people that were involved. One of the best pieces we did, each month we would look at the particular issue, whether it was housing, whether it was education, whether it was health, from a children's point of view. And the reporter would talk to a child or some children and try and get their viewpoint of what the issue looked like from through their eyes. And the book club idea was an easy, constructive way that people could interact with this project. And I think we had something like 2,500 people by the time it was all over, reading books, getting together, discussing the topics. And again, the whole thrust was towards what can I as an individual do to deal with the issue of poverty in my community. They responded in a lot of ways that I think we'll never know about. But we heard from lots of people who said, I like the series and it's motivated my church group to do this, or my civic group to do this, or the neighborhood's going to do this. Well, I believe, based on what we got, that there were lots and lots of people in the Twin Cities that said there's something I can personally do to impact the issue of poverty, and I'm going to do it. And I think they did it as a result of our series.
We reported these facts that people named did not know. They were all talking about them, and they wanted to solve them. And I think that happens a lot, actually, if we really thought about it. The media present something. People say, wow, this affects me where I live, it affects my kids and my neighbors, and I want to do something, so let's do something. And then we're at the media. If we reported on those things, I think it would complete the circle.
You know, say the word public policy and people's eyes immediately glaze over. But then in reality, people are tremendously affected by and concerned with issues like race relations and pollution and even, dare I say, politics. And if you can write about it, broadcast it, talk about it, present it in a way that, in language and in ways that match up with the concerns that real people have rather than some abstract level, you'll definitely get a response from people.
Public journalism is nothing more than very good journalism done in ways that draw readers into the story and give them something to do as a result of what they read. And I mean, it does sound corny, but there is a reason why we're mentioned in the First Amendment. And it's not because we run the TV listings, and it's not because we have sports scores, although we should have those, and that's very important. The reason we're written to the First Amendment is because we're crucial to democracy. And nothing demonstrates that better in my mind than great public journalism.
I'm pretty sure that's the end of it. Would somebody turn the lights back on? Tell me what some of your responses were to what you saw. Obviously, these are just tiny snippets from big, long stories. The main story was covered the entire front page the first day it came out. Very unusual thing for a newspaper to do. Mm-hmm. It was also a signed editorial.
I definitely believe it.
Okay. And then it had 8 days with lots of things in it. And for example, the first day had stories on the alcohol impaired is susceptible to rages of fire. Coffee brandy ranks as the state's drug of choice. A history of alcohol. Alcohol's effects on the body. How reporters researched and wrote this series. And alcohol-related deaths in 1991. All those were different stories that appeared the first day of the series. The second day, it was called Wounded by Alcohol, and the main story was about Katie Kilpatrick drank to escape, but she could not avoid the painful effects alcohol on her body and mind. Even as she suffered, she continued to drink. And then other stories were Rebuilding a Shattered Life, Anatomy of a Disease, Fetuses especially vulnerable to harm from alcohol, alcohol's heavy toll on the brain, alcohol-related deaths in 1992. And then the third day, portrait of a hard-drinking mill town. And then police make inroads with drunken driving campaign. In region renowned for drinking, AA props a door open. 12 steps to sobriety, alcohol-related deaths in 1993. And then they did that alcohol-related deaths. They kept doing 1 year, so they got closer and closer to the present. So by the end, they had the most recent year. But so they had story after story, and the section that was on kids and what it's like for kids to have parents who are drunk and end up homeless, and they had the story of a kid who was whose parents were drunk, and they lived in a car. And the teacher asked this kid, you know, what's happened? You were doing so well in school. And he was, you know, in a way, accepting this very abnormal situation as normal. And the reporter did a fabulous job of bringing that all out. And the fact that this led to so much activity, the study circles in Maine, was part of what made it one of the winners, because journalists respond to awards. And the one of the criteria for many of the awards in the public service area are having an impact. And so they could show that they really had an impact. The about race, the snippet was so short, and it was such an unbelievable program that had, I have an hour-long tape of it that captured the five-part series that they did. And the first part of it was all facts about the genetic the genetic makeup that we all have, and the part of that, which is minuscule, that is related to our skin color. And there's 106,000 genes, and there's six of them. Is that, did I have that right? Maybe you know that.
I don't know.
I think it's 106,000 genes, and only six genes have anything to do with skin color. And what, how much skin color you have depends entirely on where your ancestors, thousands of years ago, happened to live relative to the sun. And if they lived in Asia, the way the sun hit people's eyes caused them to have slanted eyes. And if you lived in around the equator, you tended to have more serotonin. And if you lived in Norway, you had lighter skin. And if and many of us in before the days when we thought sun wasn't so bad for us, used to, many white people like to go out and act like we worship the sun in order to have that serotonin be brought out. So the whole first part of that was all about that. And then the second part was about the consequences of people's perceptions and the way skin color got tied to different stereotypes. And then a third part was about race relations at work. And a fourth one was about in social life. And then there was a final segment about some action that a white woman had taken in Los Angeles, formed a whole new kind of community neighbors kind of group after the riots, after the Rodney King verdict came down. And she did a matchup thing where she invited people who wanted to get to know people of other races to give her their name and address and phone number, how many people were in the family, and if they wanted to be involved with kids and so forth. And she essentially performed a matching service and selected people who were similar in education and then matched them up and sort of watched to see what happened. And it, the implication of the story at the end was that it tended to be changing
that community where she was, and this model was being adopted in other places. And the welfare project, and now you, several of you are from, several people here this week anyway, are from Minneapolis. Are there any of you that are familiar with this Pioneer Press welfare series? Well, apparently it also had a lot of impact, and they didn't have study circles, but they did have these book clubs, and they have done several things. One thing that happened a year later, and something I'll talk more about tomorrow, is they adopted and then adapted a project that was from the state of Wisconsin that has to do with civic mapping. And part of that idea is to, for the civic journalist to find another set of sources or additional set of sources. Someone said they wanted to hear all sides. Well, normally the people you journalists learn to quote are, quote, the authorities, the leaders, or the mayor, or the people who are elected. And yet there's so much going on that affects so many other different people. And what a lot of the reporters in the Minneapolis Tribune and the Pioneer Press and one of the television stations there tried to find other places where they could find other sources of information, not the authorities, but maybe people who were more willing to talk about their own what was going on themselves and within their own lives. And they set up four places that they called third places, where that had where they put television cameras, and they just left them there. And so after a while, and they were places where people gather and talk, and after a while people got used to them and they would just communicate. And every once in a while the reporters would say, would come in or let them know that they would like people who wanted to say something more directly to the television and answer a question or two. They had four of these in and around Minneapolis. One of them was called Lucille's Kitchen. And Lucille's Kitchen was a gathering place for blacks in Minneapolis. And there developed a conversation about juvenile delinquency and vandalism. And the Lucille's Kitchen and another place, one of the other four places, got into a conversation together. And the two groups decided to get together and do something. And they did. They got together and figured out ways to deal with the juvenile delinquency and vandalism in their communities. And so it was one of the, it was another positive outcome that came from this kind of thing. Now, you didn't get too much of a chance to hear this there, but one of the things that happens, has happened in this, in as the civic journalism has gone across the, especially the smaller news media, it hasn't done too much in the great big newspapers or the great big television stations or the very big markets, but it is being successful in a lot of small ones. And you hear terms that you don't hear in the traditional journalism circles. For example, in the traditional newsroom, you'd hear words like beats, and the reporters are assigned to beats, and they have an editor that supervises them. And there's a political beat, and there's a crime beat, and there's an education beat, and there, you know, several different ones of these. Well, now they have teams, and they talk about the teams, and some of them they even call public life teams. And it's a whole new set of terminology. They talk about having toolkits for ways to get information from people that's more comfortable than having journalists come out and interview. They talk about the civic mapping and fault lines, which I will talk more about tomorrow. They talk about these third places. They talk about catalysts, who are people who aren't thought of as experts or sources usually by journalists, but they are people who make things happen in their neighborhoods. And all of you who have an interest in community organizing know who those people are. You may use that term, but you may use
another one. They are very eager to make sure that all the stakeholders are represented, all sides. They open up their editorial board meetings. The Portland Oregonian, for example, and the Colorado Springs Gazette have their board meetings. They're what used to be the editorial meetings where they decide on the play of the stories. And they're generally considered only the top people get to go. They have them in the middle of their newsrooms. And everybody who's involved is welcome. And in one community, community people are welcome to come in and sit in on those and contribute as well. So there's a whole kind of new way of thinking about it. As you hear people talking about this, they talk about how it's about in-depth reporting, it's interactive, it's a catalyst for conversations in communities, it's courageous, it's thorough, let me go back to the courageous. This About Race project was a very courageous thing for this television station to do in San Francisco during Sweeps Weeks. The boss in that television station, I heard him speak, and he was extremely upset that this station was planning to air this during Sweeps because they were certain that the ratings would go down. Well, as you heard, they stayed stable. They didn't go up, but staying stable was a victory in this particular instance. You hear words like dialogue. We want to have a dialogue with people in the community rather than the one-way communication that the news media normally have been. They talk about citizen participation, sense of purpose, connectivity, capacity building. All these are terms you hear from organizers and from Jody and John's work on asset building in communities. You don't normally hear this in newspapers. At the same time, the same group of people, you get them together at the kind of regular workshops that the Pew Center for Civic Journalism holds, and you hear them talk about commitment, where they're part of a movement, they've been converted, they go on retreats. You hear them say, it's changed my life. Mm-hmm. They're all very kind of religious terms. And so the people who aren't into this and who don't agree with it hear them talking like that, and the guard immediately goes up. But it's difficult to fight because the strategists who put together the Pew Center for Civic Journalism and Batten himself, who'd started the public journalism part of it, were all very highly respected, award-winning journalists. Ed Fooey, who was the first director of the Pew Center for Civic Journalism in Washington, D.C., was a very well-known television and very well-respected by his peers. The current director of it is Jan Schaefer, and she was a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who broke the app scam story and all this kind of thing. So when the journalists with those kind of credentials are doing this and pushing it, then it's more likely that the others, the sociology of it is such that the others will begin to be able to, pay more attention to it. Now, I should have said earlier, the Pew Center for Civic Journalism was funded by the Pew Charitable Trust in Philadelphia. And they said that they would support this Pew Center for Civic Journalism for 10 years. And they're now in the seventh year. And so they've got only 3 more years to go. I'm a little worried it's not going to be long enough, but it certainly has caught on. And what happens is that if journalists, newsrooms and whatever that want to participate in this can send a proposal to the Pew Center for Civic Journalism and ask for funding that would pay for their out-of-pocket costs. And the out-of-pocket costs very often will include something like a community survey. Well, where the newspaper pays somebody to do a survey to find out what the issues are in a community. And they've done that now. Most
organizations are expected to work with another media organization in their own community, a newspaper with a television station or a radio station or whatever, so it's not just one. And these normally competing people are supposed to work together on a project, and they decide what they're going to do, and then Pew will fund up to about $50,000 of these out-of-pocket costs for about 3 years, and they don't like to go much beyond that because then they like to see it integrated into the newsrooms that they've been funding. So there have been quite a number of these around the country, and I can tell you of either a long or a short story about one in Seattle. There have been several in Spokane. There's an editor who's very much into this in Spokane, Chris Peck. And there's, in fact, there's a speech he gave here, the civic journalism, the savior of our newspapers in the 21st century, ? And so you can take just a few of those. And there's also some copies, a couple copies of this, what was going on in Maine, the deadliest drug. And then there's some articles here by this Jay Rosen, who's kind of a guru from New York University, who was one of the first ones involved in this as an academic. And that was an article he wrote some time ago about it. There's a huge range of stories, of types of projects that have been done with this kind of brand put on them. And some of them, a lot of them started out looking at elections. And then in the off-election years, you tend to get a focus on other kinds of issues. During the election years, starting from about now until after the election's over, you can hardly get journalists and newsrooms to pay attention to anything other than the elections. And you can't get them to spend money on anything else. But on the off-election years, they will, and you'll find them on find a lot of these civic journalism projects focused on race and poverty. There was one in Peoria where they decided they needed to do a project in their town on leadership because all of a sudden it was time to elect a new mayor and nobody wanted to run. So they said they decided they had a problem in this community and they had to talk about leadership, and they did. And so that was one of the a very interesting one. Then in Portland, Oregon, they decided, because of the credibility project that the American Society for Newspaper Editors had done, one of the things they found out in doing that was that people were really pretty upset with the way crime is covered. We discussed that a little bit, and the ASNE just gave grants to six different newspapers to try something different. And in Portland, they decided to change their crime coverage from the ground up. And they created a crime team. They did away with police reporters, which was one of the ways junior reporters in the past got started as police reporters. And there are routines and traditions associated with it. But in Oregon now, they're doing it completely differently, and they've got eight people on a team, and they take turns covering courts and so forth, but it's a much more integrated kind of thing. When there is a crime in the community, they talk a lot more about the community. They talk a lot more about the context, the frequency of whatever kind of crime occurred, and they do things that take the fear out of it for readers. They give them the information readers want to be able to distance themselves and tell themselves that it won't happen to me. But if they may find out with this detail that it's more likely to happen to them than some other crimes. But it's very interesting what they've done, and they won an award for that this year. There's in Madison, Wisconsin, they started having mock grand juries and mock legislatures and the newspaper and there and the whole group, there was a team of media that did this, and they put on this joint project in order with the idea of getting the people to make decisions about taxes, to make decisions about gambling in that state, and also various kinds of health care reform. And so they had all these discussions, and all that was done before the elected legislature had these discussions, and people were prepared to ask questions and to make demands of the legislators. Let's see, there was, in your communities where you all are from, can you think of topics where your community, there's an issue that needs to be dealt with that could benefit from this kind of project? And are the press, are the media in your communities up to this? Are they willing to try something new?
I have a question kind of related to that, the stuff that you do, Joni. When you go into a community and you start doing this community building asset, will the newspaper and the media cover what you do?
Sometimes. When I was in your town last year in Davenport, they gave me some good coverage. I think it really does depend on the culture of the newspaper. I think Marco's exactly right. There are some papers that get it, that there are actors that are not elected officials and that are not heads of departments and that are not the usual suspects, and that there's stuff going on under the radar out in communities, and that's important stuff for the city, and therefore they'll cover it.
Even though it doesn't bleed.
Even though it doesn't bleed, that's right. But I think there are other places where the kind of work that goes on at the community level just is absolutely invisible and beyond the pale and not considered news, particularly when it doesn't bleed, particularly when it's about citizens building solutions to problems, not being problems themselves, right? I mean, one of the things that's clear is that we've always thought that particularly low-income neighborhoods produce mainly problems to be covered, right? And when you start thinking about the solutions that neighborhoods produce, you have to sort of put on a different pair of glasses to see it and probably invent a different language to make people interested in it, to see the drama in it, to see why they should be reading about it. It was interesting that all three of those examples, Margo, just really did take off at the grassroots level.
Yeah.
Got people engaged.
Well, and there are literally hundreds more. I mean, I'm doing a research project now for the Ford Foundation on this, and we've cataloged about over 250 of these projects going on around the country. And often the media in one town will get together and do one, and they'll have kind of a so-so response to it themselves, and in the community too. And then there'll be one or two journalists that'll get turned on by this, and so they'll want to have another one. And they'll start at another one. And the second or third one seems to catch on from the point of view of getting the whole communities involved and really kind of understanding that. I think it was one of you two this morning made the comment that it's journalists as organizers, mm-hmm. as community organizers. That there's a new thing that happens. Another thing that's really interesting to me is in almost all of these cases, the people who are pulling this off most successfully are women or minorities. You don't find the traditional older white males who own the papers and who are the publishers actually doing this, although more and more of them have become enamored of it. It's a real interesting factor. There's also people are now, it's gotten popular enough that people are saying things, well, like investigative journalism is really civic journalism, and then they'll tell you why and they'll explain it, and
since computers have come in so heavily in the news media, now you have journalists who are doing, they're social science, doing database analyses that become the basis for news stories. And that's all, they'll say that's civic journalism. And so there's, and to an extent it is. And it depends on how much there is a concern in this engagement of citizens as part of what they do.
Let me ask, Martin, what's your sense after 6 or 7 years of this stuff about its future? Our friend Byron White at the Tribune in Chicago is convinced that this stuff goes nowhere unless the people who are concerned about the bottom line and profit see some positive impact.
Yeah.
And I noticed that in a number of the stories you told us, when there was evidence that it impacted the bottom line, the circulation went up, that ad rates went up, that you emphasized that.
Yeah.
Is there evidence across the board that says that, at least in most instances, this kind of journalism does in fact impact the bottom line?
No.
Okay.
There's not evidence of much of anything. And
okay.
part of the trouble is that journalists don't do things in a way that allow you to collect good social science data. And it's very, very hard to know. I said that in Charlotte, there are more people voted. Well, they in that particular place, they did an experiment where they had two editions of the paper, and one edition that went to a certain part of the county had this information in it, and the other one didn't. And in this one, more people voted. So there was better evidence. But people are bombarded by so much different information every day, it's virtually impossible to say, you know, that this piece of information had an impact and this one doesn't. I mean, it's very, very hard to measure. One of the questions that they ask all the time is, did it move the needle? And that's their way of saying, did it make a difference? And what now you've got is journalists convinced that it makes a difference. I mean, if you interview teachers, they think class size makes a difference in how well they can teach and how well students learn. But over and over again, for a long, long time anyway, there was lots of data showing that class size didn't make a difference. But these journalists who are into this and are committed and have been converted and say their lives have changed are 100% convinced that this is making a difference in their communities. And they'll give you bits of evidence that hard-nosed social scientists would not think was evidence. And so it's really hard to answer that question. And I think you're right that the owners and publishers want to know what the bottom line looks like. Has it increased? There's no doubt about it, this kind of journalism can be expensive. And when you're paying $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 for a relatively small sample, you know, for a survey of, you know, community survey with 450 respondents or something, which isn't all that good a sample, the question, it's okay if the paper is getting the money from the Pew Center to pay for the survey, but are they going to start doing this? Are they going to be willing to do this on a long-term basis? And there's some evidence that some of them will. But then they have to believe that they're going to make up their costs otherwise. And this is happening at a time when all the media are putting lots and lots of money into the internet, and at the moment not getting much return. They still can't figure out how they're going to make money with the internet. And a few of them are beginning to. But you know, that's a good question. Ingrid, were you going to say something?
It just seems like the Chicago Tribune has done the opposite, but sort of under the same, something of the same kind of thinking, like they did a series a couple of years ago, on they said for the whole year to make a big deal of every child that died in the city. And so...
It was killed by violence.
It was killed by violence. Or it was killed. I suppose all killings are violent. And so for a whole year, every single child under 16 or something who died not of natural causes or illness was featured in the paper. I'm sure they thought it would... I suppose they thought it would make a difference somehow, but it didn't, except that it probably sold more papers. And then there was one more...
Scared people after that, too.
Yeah. And there was one more body that was found recently that had got died in that year, who, you know, been buried in somebody's backyard. And so then the whole thing came up again just a week or two ago, and I was reminded about it. And it was just, it was not a good idea for them to do that. And now they're doing something at Cabrini, a series on a public housing project. And I haven't read it, so I don't know what that's all about, but I have a sense that it's sensational again. You know? It's not. Oh, it's not. Oh, good. So
well, a lot of times they, those disconnected kinds of crime stories are the ones that are most scary for people. They need to understand why something happened to someone in order to figure out what it has to do with them.
They almost had a competition going that year. How many children had died the previous year, and are we going to exceed that number? You know, it was hundreds and hundreds of
children. It's a game prank for killing.
Yeah. There was a, I heard recently, and maybe you guys, people from the Chicago area know this, I heard that the Sun-Times made an editorial decision in response to focus groups that they held with readers not to put non-Chicago crime on the front page. And so the, for example, that Colorado Springs, how could I forget the name of that high school?
Columbine.
Yeah, Columbine. How they, that was not on the front page mm-hmm. of the Chicago Sun-Times. Well, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. And do you know anything more about that?
I know, but that's what I heard too. That there was they did a survey.
Mm-hmm.
And they said one of the things we don't like is to hear about crimes. If you're going to tell us about crimes, at least make them Chicago crimes, right?
Yeah.
With the Littleton coverage, I think it was partly a copycat. Will kids in our area see this and be traumatized from copycat stuff? I think there was some thinking along the lines of that.
With the Chicago
Sun-Times?
Wow. And they thought if they put it, I mean, I guess it was on the third page.
Yeah.
But it would help to cut the chances of that?
Well, just because I think there's a feeling, and it's probably true to some extent, that kids get ideas from all kinds of media things, and this was just another way of feeding into that, and that in a way that the kids act out that way, knowing they're going to get recognition, notoriety, fame by doing it. I'm not sure how much there is to all of that, but I think that's some of the thinking that was part of it.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm going to. I know you teach journalism, and I'm wondering what how your students react to this kind of thing, or if they have any interest in it, or are trying any of it themselves.
Civic journalism?
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting. It's teaching journalism at the high school level is a wonderful Holden-like situation in a way. It's sort of pure journalism. You have a community right there, and you can always be thinking about the community to whatever extent you want to. And at Oak Park, we have a great mix of people in the school. And so part of the challenge is just, is the mix being covered in any way. And I'm real happy to think and see that the kids really are sort of tuning into to that to some extent. I think there's always room for us to do more with it. But civic journalism is really in a lot of ways what real good high school journalism is about. And the team building, maestro approach that you hear about sometimes nowadays, those things are things that work real well at the high school level. And you just sort of hope that when you send them off that they're not going to get shattered into some commercial situation 4 or 5 years down the line where they just have to start grinding it out and be part of the system. I actually brought something I downloaded before we came up here, a guy who did work for the Pew Fellowship, an international mm-hmm. story that he got a grant for. He worked for the Sun-Times. He was an editor on our paper in the 80s. And so there's at least one successful
one international maybe you can show us the international one. Well, I thought I would tell you a little bit about the one in Seattle, just because, what are we doing then? Oh, we're already over, I'm sorry. Well, maybe tomorrow I'll tell you about the Seattle one, because it involved, it was so interesting to me as a social scientist to see how the journalists are making use of social science techniques and calling them something completely different and much more interesting. And they're really becoming good social scientists while they do it. And I'll just tell you this one thing part. To get the Civic Journalism Project started in Seattle, all the different media involved, they had a partnership of four different media, the public television station, the public radio station, two public radio stations, and the Seattle Times, which is privately owned. And they wanted to do a public journalism project, and they had this Front Porch Forum logo that they had used on their election studies that they'd done before, and they wanted to do another project, but they really didn't know what it should be on. So they decided to have pizza on the porch. And it was, the pizza was literally on neighbors' front porches, but also it was, the cost was on the project, on the Front Porch Forum project. And so that all the different media advertised, and they asked people if they'd be willing to have 10 neighbors come and sit on their porch and have pizza that the Times would pay, that the project would pay for. And then they had to answer, they had to fill out a questionnaire at the end, which would basically tell, you know, what they talked about and what they thought the region's most serious problems were, and any ideas they had for solving those problems. So about 1,500 people said that they would be willing to have 10 others to their house to have pizza on the porch. And they all got these vouchers to go get pizza from a local pizza dealer. But they didn't all end up having pizza on the porch. There were about 720 of the vouchers were actually used. And there were about, I think it was something like 380 of the forms were actually made it back to the Front Porch Forum project. But they represented about 4,000 people who had gathered on the porches to have this conversation about what the most serious problems were confronting the Puget Sound region. And it was a form of a focus group that the social scientists use all the time. But it was one that was really intriguing for them, and it didn't have some of the stiffness that a lot of those focus groups had. And people really got stuff out. So I'll tell you what happened after that tomorrow. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thanks. If you want any of these extra things, please take them, because I don't want to have to take them.
Now, when are you going to tell us how to get this turned in our own local?
Well, maybe I'll start that tomorrow, because I think there's...